Hello and welcome to The Ohm Show. Today I'm talking to Steve Tidball, who's the co-founder of a very interesting adventure clothing brand called Wallaback. Did I get this right, Steve?
You got it right.
All right. I've been practicing. Is it Wallaback or is it Wallaback? How does it go?
Well, it originally comes from Flemish, and I say Wallaback, but I'm routinely corrected by everyone who's from Holland or anywhere nearby about how you actually say it. But at the moment, I stick to Wallaback until corrected again.
So what does it really mean?
Well, it originally came from the world of cycling. It means all out or foot to the floor or full gas or go for it. And I came across the phrase about 10 years ago, and essentially it was a single word that summarized an attitude. And at a time, I'd been rooting around for a name of the brand that summarized that kind of attitude, found it and stuck with it. And so 10 years later, we're left with a brand that starts with a V and ends with a K, which may not be great, but says something good.
I am pretty sure getting the domain name wasn't a problem.
It was no problem at all.
Okay, that's good.
No one had taken anything to do with it.
I know. That is one of the key things you have to think as an entrepreneur these days. If you have a brand, can you get the domain name and can you get the social media handles?
Yeah, well, luckily, pretty much everything was free, .com, .co.uk, all the social media handles. I think there was one guy in, Holland at the time with 8 followers who maybe had one handle. That was it. So it wasn't too much of a challenge.
And how long ago did you start the company?
So we started trading 4 years ago, but the original idea probably we came up with 10 years ago when my brother and I were racing ultramarathons around the world. And essentially, we got into quite a few difficulties and we kind of wondered if clothing could be part of the solution. So I think probably the first time we actually thought, I wonder if we could do a clothing brand, was we were about to do a race across the Namib Desert in Namibia. And we were going to get up and we knew the next day it was going to be around 130 degrees. And we're going to run for about 24 hours across a desert where in the end, you know, we had friends who were hunted down by jackals. So it's like, it's a pretty fun place to be. And the night before, we weren't alone in that hardly any of us could sleep. And so we were about to do something really tough in a desert, threatening your life, and you're sitting there wide awake all night in a tent. And it's just like the worst type of preparation in the world, because you always imagine you're going to go into these big races really well rested in prime form. And the fact is we hadn't slept. And I think so probably one of the earliest ideas we had for starting the company was, I wonder if a piece of clothing could solve that. That's where we very originally started from. And then 5 years later, because we didn't crack on with the idea straight away, 5 years later, we ended up designing something called a relaxation hoodie, or originally called a Baker Miller pink hoodie. And we got a very lucky break when the comedian John Glazer took it onto the Jimmy Fallon Tonight Show. And the two of them put on this like pretty insane looking pink hoodie, zipped it up over their faces, and then tried to relax in front of a really large studio audience. And that was the start of the business.
So just for those of us who don't know, the English speak, trading means you started your business.
Oh, sorry, we started selling, yes.
In US, trading means being listed on the stock market. Right. And so just to give more clarity on your company, you guys make extreme clothing in a way that it's not just for extreme sports, but it's for extreme condition.
Correct.
And what kind of clothing is that?
The idea of the company was to essentially look at what the future of clothing should be like. So we looked at every other industry, and you had it in cars, you know, you had Tesla and rockets in food, you had lots of different people building the future, and we couldn't see that being done in clothing. So that was our original idea. And then because we were adventure sports athletes ourselves, our idea was simply, well, let's make the future of clothing for adventure sports athletes. And there's an incredibly good reason for this, which is these are people who are risking their lives on a daily basis, whether it's out in big waves or up mountains or chucking themselves out of planes. And so if there's one area you're going to need clothing to really perform, it's in extreme and adventure sport. And so the idea essentially was, let's shoot the future of clothing through the lens of adventure sport. And to date, we've made the world's first jacket out of graphene. We've made hoodies that slow down your brainwaves. We've made pants that last 100 years. So we're slowly moving through your wardrobe, remaking each piece in a more interesting way than it's perhaps been made before.
So this is not unique, right? Like, this is not a new idea, because if you look at the Patagonia and North Face, both the companies were started by adventure sports guys, and they looked at materials to basically protect them in extreme conditions. I mean, the Patagonia hoodie and the Patagonia vest and the Patagonia puffer came out of this desire to kind of have one piece of clothing that survived and helped adventure sports people everywhere. But what I find interesting about your company is that you're actually experimenting with materials which are not commonplace. These are exotic materials almost. And why? Why is that? Like, why are you so drawn to things like graphene, for example? And, you know, it's like when there is a lot of other materials which are more commonly available and actually more affordable, isn't that like there are two kinds of innovation, right? Like you're yeah. just going to the very extreme. Why is that?
I think it's really interesting you use the example of Patagonia, and I'd also go as far back as using Nike as well. And when you originally had Bowman creating the world's first running trainers using a waffle iron, like you've had a really long history of maverick inventors inventing really crazy stuff. And what we've always loved about that is they're not limited by what has gone before. So there was absolutely no reason to use a waffle iron on rubber in order to create a pair of shoes. And at the same time, Yvon Chouinard, when he first started Patagonia, he was importing English rugby shirts for a while because he thought they were incredibly hard wearing. So interestingly, I don't think we're actually doing anything new in going around the world and looking at materials that haven't been used before. I think what we do that's unusual is, as you say, look for materials that really haven't been used in clothing before. So I think one of the reasons we're drawn to it is not necessarily for the materials themselves, but in order to answer the briefs that we set ourselves. For instance, I'll use one example was a jacket we made called the Solar Charge Jacket, and it stores and re-emits sunlight. So effectively, you can glow through bits of the night like a firefly. Now, the reason that started off was we'd been running a race over the Alps, and the visibility got really low, down to 5 meters, and you're on these kind of crazy precipice edges of mountains thinking, I can't really see, but I'm trying to run really fast. Wouldn't it be great if I was my own light source? And so when you set yourself kind of really distinct and interesting challenges like that, you look around at the clothing that exists and go, well, actually, none of it solves that. And so you are just drawn to inherently more interesting materials. The graphene jacket was another one where, honestly, that came out of my desire to use graphene. I mean, I'd been reading about it for years. I'd read the original research where they'd won the Nobel Prize for it. The honest answer is we were looking for any opportunity to be able to use it. Now, the reason we thought it would be exciting is because it can store and distribute heat in a way that normal materials can't. And so essentially, we looked at that and wondered if that could be used in an interesting way in clothing. Even then, we put it out as a really kind of like experimental piece because it's essentially a very lightweight jacket. And so there's no way it's going to be able to keep you as warm as a puffer jacket. So we were kind of looking to our customers to go, okay, what could this be used for? And in the end, it was them who gave us the answer. One guy was kept alive in the mountains of Nepal after he got lost, and he held it out like a solar sail to collect heat and then put it on, and it kept him warm through the night when he'd lost his way. Another guy, an American scientist, ended up tying it to the belly of his camel in the Gobi Desert when he was cold one night. The camel's heat transferred into the jacket. He took the jacket off the camel 30 minutes later and put the jacket back on. So one of the reasons we're drawn to interesting materials like this is because out of it comes stories and ideas that will inevitably lead us to more research and new and different ideas.
Graphene is typically used in race cars, exotic race cars. And I've seen it in some high-end audio systems. And
yes.
And so it's like, what goes in your mind? Like yeah, I'm going to make a jacket out of it. Like graphene jacket, like why? I mean, that just is such an insane idea, but why?
I think it's probably the challenge.
Yeah.
I think it's probably the idea that A, it hasn't been done before, and B, you've got lots of people telling you that it's not possible. And also, I kind of find it really fun. Like I really loved competing at sport. My brother and I have competed our whole lives in sport. And the idea that there would be a bunch of people also attempting to make clothing with graphene and that we could be first, I think it was the challenge of, can we win?
Yeah.
I think that's probably it. That's probably the motivation.
And your brother's name is Nick, and he's the co-founder of
the
company.
Yes, so he's co-founder and my twin brother, and we've worked together for the last 20 years.
That is pretty cool. So graphene may be the most exotic thing you use in your clothing, but it's not the only one. I saw that you make t-shirts out of algae.
Yeah.
And you make one of the jackets you make, which I actually ended up buying.
indestructible the puffer.
Which is like made out of...
It's made out of Dyneema.
Yeah, and I love Dyneema. I have no idea why, but I have so many things made out of Dyneema in my life. I have no clue. But I just am, you know, fascinated by that fabric.
So the Dyneema fabric is really crazy. And again, it was another challenge. Like, that has actually been used in really high-end backpacks that have been made before. But it's a certain type of Dyneema that's been used before. And we got hold of this special version that you could use to make clothes out of. And like, your inner child basically is just compelled to use it. As soon as you hear that a material is 15 times stronger than steel weight for weight, you want to use it because there's something really good about that. And obviously then once you found that material, then you just look for an application. And one of the things that we've always found crazy is that these really super high-end puffer jackets, I think one of our customers said it the other day, they can't withstand a cat claw, but you pay $1,000 for them. And so we thought, wouldn't it be great if you take something that is actually normally thought about as actually quite fragile and make it inherently strong? I think it ties in with the t-shirt you talked about, the plant and algae t-shirt, because that came out of another race that we'd done. So my brother was racing through the Amazon. And at the end of this 7-day ultra marathon, all the competitors, their clothes were so covered in blood and feces and kind of all sorts of stuff that you would have if you raced through the Amazon for 7 days, that they burnt all of their clothes. And I remember him coming back and he'd watched this pile of burning clothes and gone, this is just completely insane. It's a bunch of people who love racing around the world, who love being in nature, but somehow they're just doing this insane act at the end of a race. And that was probably 10 years ago. And his original idea was, well, what if we could create a completely circular piece of clothing that takes very, very little energy to create, and what, at the end of its life, you can just bury it in the ground and it turns back into nature. And that was a 10-year project from start to finish, from the very start of that idea of how are we going to make something like this, through to getting a t-shirt that hadn't ever been touched by chemicals, was made with eucalyptus pulp, and then even the print was algae. And eventually we ended up with something that you could bury back in the ground and it would leave no trace that it even existed. Mm. And that's where we're trying to get to. I think that was a really important moment this summer when we launched that, because I think what was interesting about it is there is quite correctly a huge emphasis going on sustainability by many clothing brands, and it's absolutely the right way to move. What I was very interested in doing is making something that was actually fun. I think that while lots of people have done lots of very cool things, I think there's a difference between doing the right thing and doing it in a way that really motivates people to actually take action or think about stuff. And so the idea really behind that was this kind of action that I don't actually think anyone's taken yet, because the t-shirts are still going, they're only sold in the summer, of when you're finished with this, bury it in your garden. Because when you do that, that's going to be quite a moment, because it's a very strange thing to do. And I think it sort of comes full circle for us. It's the opposite of burning stuff in the Amazon, basically.
How many products do you have as a company? Like, how many products do you make?
We have about 35 at the moment. So we started off with 2 4 years ago, and then we've just carried on adding every time we have a good idea. We don't do seasons or anything that clothing brands typically do. We essentially, when we have an idea, we start making it. Sometimes they take a year to make, sometimes they take 4 years. And when it's ready, it comes out.
This plant and algae t-shirt.
Yes.
You said 10 years in the making?
Well, 10 years from the idea, but then when we actually started trying to work out how to physically make that, 3.5 years.
How did that happen? Like, what was the process like?
The first thing we had to do was essentially find the base of the t-shirt. So you can use cotton, but the problem with materials like cotton is they take a huge amount of water to create. Typically, there's a process they go through as well before color is added, where it's basically a chemical process that a dye can be put on. And so that by the time it gets to you, it's consumed a huge amount of energy to get to you, basically. And so we had to start from scratch of finding material which had consumed far less energy, but also been grown in nature and then could go back in the ground. In both cases, actually, for the plant and algae t-shirt, we ended up with 2 German partners. So one in making the fabric, which is made out of pulped trees, essentially from sustainably managed forests. And then we worked with 2 German scientists who had found a process for turning algae into dye. But then, of course, you have to persuade the people who print t-shirts to use algae, not ink. And so at every stage of the process of making that t-shirt, you have to kind of break the traditional manufacturing process, even when you get to the suppliers who want to sew a label in the t-shirt for sizing, and you can't let them do it.
So what's more exciting to you, the creation process, or is it when somebody buys it and wears it and emails you and says, wow, that was amazing? Or where do you get your kicks from?
I get my kicks from them being worn. I think the interesting thing about innovation is it's only relevant if it's actually adopted. I don't think Ford would have been particularly happy if everyone went, no, I don't like these cars, I'm happy with my horse, or Edison with the light bulb, if everyone had carried on with flames. I think it's most satisfying when you invent stuff, when you have a real interaction with someone who's worn it and loved it and is doing something with it. That's almost always more exciting than the conception of the idea itself.
I often think about that. I think when you look at successful products, there is the inventor, creator of the product, who loves the creation process. And then there is the one who actually wants to bring it to the people who kind of consume it. And I always wonder, like they have a different level of motivations and different reasons for motivation. Are you and Nick on the same page, or is it different kinds of motivation? Like, how does that work?
Interestingly, before this, we worked in advertising for 15 years, and we had very, very different roles there. In the end, I did a lot of the strategic work. His job was primarily to come up with ideas. And it's interesting, when we originally started the company, I was allowed to come up with clothing ideas, but increasingly he doesn't let me. And so now he controls all of the creative, but I control all the business. I think there probably is a different motivation. I think essentially, even if we sold nothing to anybody at any point, he would still be very busy coming up with lots of ideas, where I'm probably a little bit more practically motivated, where I like to see it through and experience the sale. I know he does too, but essentially he's definitely the artist in the garret working away.
Yeah. So tell me more about your transition from, you know, you're in advertising and now you're making clothes, which are kind of insane in many ways.
Well, it was really funny. I mean, we started in advertising at a very strange era. So we started in the early 2000s, so 2002. And advertising was about to make that really strange transition away from really huge blockbuster ads, because essentially what started to happen was you started to see the media landscape fragmenting, and people hadn't really got a hold of what it was going to become. And, you know, since then we know what it's going to become. The media landscape has fragmented, and social is now absolutely huge, and most advertising budget goes towards Google and Facebook. But at the time, it was like the end of the dinosaur era, where these huge TV ads, everyone still wanted to make them, but no one was really watching them. And so it was this really kind of empty creative process where it was art being made for art's sake. And we came in at the death of that, essentially, at a time when a new advertising was being formed. And I think we were very, very lucky to be there at that moment, because essentially, by the time we left, where it had moved towards was essentially advertising was much closer to PR. It was solving very, very tight briefs around perception, of attempting to position brands in really, really interesting ways, and using the media in a very interesting way. So instead of paying for media, essentially making a story that's so interesting that the media has to run it. So one of my favorite campaigns we did actually just before we left was an awareness campaign for Airbnb in the UK, it was several years ago now, so they weren't as big and famous as they are now. And we built a fully functioning house and floated it along the River Thames. And it is one of those images that went around the world so fast. It went to a lot of countries and a lot of different newspapers very, very quickly, and did a job far beyond what it was supposed to do, which was let people in London know that Airbnb exists. And even on conservative estimates, I think that image ended up being seen by a couple of 100 million people, because it was just so interesting. It was a fairy tale house floating through the River Thames, past London landmarks, past the Houses of Parliament. And so I think we left advertising at a really good time, when those kind of ideas were a lot more pervasive than when we originally started, where you had big TV ads being made and no one necessarily watching them. The transition away was in part helped by the world as we understood it at the end of advertising. And where we started off was essentially, what if each piece of clothing we made almost functioned like an ad? What if, you know, even in the title of that piece of clothing, you understood what it was supposed to do? And so one of the first kind of like fun pieces of clothing we made was a 100-year hoodie. It's designed to last 100 years. So it's not particularly complicated, but you kind of get what that's supposed to do. Same with like the solar charged jacket. And essentially we started moving through clothing, finding and creating these crazy materials, and then trying to bring them to an audience really simply with ideas that effectively worked a bit like an ad, so you could get it really fast.
What you're saying is that you know, yes, it's a product, but every product has a story, and every story is an ad in itself. Essentially, that's what your brief for your company and your products was.
Yes.
And which company were you, which advertising agency were you at?
So you worked for TBWA. So in the US, that's much better known as Chiat Day, who look after Apple. And one of the first people we sort of dared to talk to about what we were planning was a guy called Lee Clow, who created most of the really famous Apple ads from 1984 to the dancing people for the iPod. And we summoned up courage to go and show Lee some really early sketches. And he loved it. And he just, he said that Steve would liked it if he'd still been around. And he said how cool it was. And he was actually the first person to go, well, I love this. This is clothes with stories. And I don't remember at the time being particularly dumbfounded by that as an idea. But a couple of years later, we thought we should probably listen to that guy. He probably knows a thing or two about what he's doing.
Yeah. And I think the more interesting part of your journey so far for me is, in many ways, your brand is a brand of hope. And also it's a brand for a very dystopian tomorrow. And in a way, you know, you talk about a 100-year hoodie, indestructible puffer, you know, solar charge. I mean, all those pieces of clothing, the names, you know, they fit the narrative of the Cybertruck,
I agree.
Climate change, you know, and like the idea of a Mad Max future. Which side of the narrative do you fall on?
We're at a really funny moment where the first time we're actually able to explore the idea of living on different planets at the moment when we're, to all intents and purposes, getting fairly close to destroying our own. So I think from a design perspective, we've always wanted a design for reality. And the reality is the world is definitely getting crazier. Like you can see it, like whichever side of the fence you come down on, there are huge parts of various countries on fire and flooding. And so I think from a design perspective, running towards that reality is both interesting and the correct thing to do. So yeah, we sit firmly in the cyber truck camp of the idea of something built for one of the most, you know, he's building it for essentially an incredibly hostile environment, Mars. And by the way, while you can't get to Mars, you can drive it here on Earth. We have a very, very similar design philosophy.
Yeah, it's like he talks about Mars, I'm pretty sure, but Cybertruck is probably in many ways, if you look at it, if you look at what it stands for, is a world which is going to be a little bit more charged and, you know, unstable and much more violent going forward, not to mention more unsettled because of climate change. And I think to have, you know, it's like it's a fierce looking, almost robotic, you know, vehicle. And, you know, like I bought your puffer and I was like, it almost feels like a shield, right? Like, you know,
yes.
that it's going to protect me if it's like suddenly, you know, San Francisco becomes a tundra like place. But some days I wake up and just think, well, you know, we're going to figure this out. The technology and science will help us figure it out. And so I think that is an interesting point in time right now. I think 2020, we are all kind of unable to decide whether technology will save us or we are all going to hell.
I think there's definitely a mindset where people are buying for protection. But I think there's also a mindset of excitement at change. I think if you look at the history of humanity, we're definitely sort of a frontier-based species. Whenever there's been a significant challenge, whether it's Africa drying out 50,000 years ago, or hey, there's some gold over this place in America, let's go get it. We're definitely a species driven by frontiers and change. And if you look at all the most radical periods of change throughout history, some incredible innovations come out of them. So whilst you never wish to be in the place we are now, I think it's almost inevitable that it will push us towards innovations that perhaps wouldn't otherwise have come about, in the same way as heading to the moon left us with a whole series of innovations that no one had anticipated. I think the place we find ourselves in now will compel some of the brightest minds in the world to come up with solutions that otherwise wouldn't have happened. So I think it's not entirely doom. I think things will come out of this where we attempt to fix it because we have a track record of doing it.
I definitely agree with you on that. I'm on the camp of, you know, believers that technology and science have the answers for us. But there are days when it's really hard to kind of not listen to the narrative out there and just say, things are looking pretty tough. I mean, you look at Australia burning and, you know, just like, wow, that is pretty extreme. And sometimes I wonder, maybe that is the way of Mother Nature balancing out, you know, and taking care of the invasive species that human beings are. And then, you know, we have a, you know, virus scare in China right now and seems to be pretty bad. And part of me just says, maybe it just is, you know, universe, the nature balancing out, you know, what it's supposed to do. It just kind of taking care of all the stupidity we have unleashed on it.
There's a wonderful quote by the physicist Michio Kaku, who looks at the idea that we're essentially the only intelligent species to have existed. And he sort of looks at three key reasons for that, which is opposable thumbs, language, and predator vision. And gets to the point of saying, well, basically evolution has created one intelligent species. The point he makes out of that is, well, maybe intelligence isn't necessary. If we're the only intelligent species and we've only been around for 100,000 years, but other species were around for millions of years, maybe we're not that necessary. And it ties in with another one of my favorite quotes from a British guy called Martin Rees, who's the Astronomer Royal, who says, brilliant quote of, we have no reason to believe that we are the culmination of evolution. I think what was really interesting is keeping those two things in mind. We're at a really staggeringly interesting moment where we can either wipe ourselves off the face of the Earth or we can become an intergalactic species. And like both of those appear to be possibilities right now. So as a time to be alive, this is a rather fascinating one. Mm-hmm. Like if you'd been born 1,000 years ago, neither of those things were true. Mother Nature wasn't about us to wipe us out, and nor were we about to go and colonize Mars. So I think it's an extraordinary moment to be alive. I'd love to be able to take some kind of pill that could keep me alive for the next few hundred years, because I think it's probably going to be one of the most extraordinary in human evolution. It's just how long you're going to be here to see it.
Yeah. All right, let's get back to your brand and your clothing. Has Elon reached out to you and said, I want some of that stuff? No. I mean, this is right up his alley right now.
There was a poster site outside SpaceX, so we took it. We built something called a deep sleep cocoon, and the idea was to tackle sleeping conditions in space. So the International Space Station, they face 16 sunrises and sunsets a day. And even when Aldrin and Armstrong were coming back from the moon, they couldn't sleep when they were on the Eagle because the lighting was so harsh. So we built a top to tackle this called the deep sleep cocoon, a bit like a woodlouse meets a space helmet. And we really wanted to tell Elon about it. But instead of like getting his email, we thought the funniest thing was to buy the billboard outside SpaceX HQ. And so we put a billboard up that a friend of ours helped us write. And it just says, we finished our jacket. How's your rocket going? So I know that several of his staff saw it. Some quite high up people there. We're yet to get an email. So what we're waiting to do is we're going to take the poster site out when it's free again. And I'll put my email up there and see if he takes it.
Yeah, I think Elon should fund you guys forever, I think. I mean, you know, there is no one who probably will understand your mission better than him. There is a certain nuttiness in your mission and his. So, and you know, why not? It should be an interesting meeting of the minds. I would love to be a fly on the wall when that happens.
I certainly wouldn't be averse to it. Yeah. I think we've got a similar mindset. He's just got a slightly different bank account.
Yeah, you know, bank accounts don't make a man. Let's just be clear. They definitely make you dress better. And they make you more respectable in eyes of other people who respect money. But they don't make you. You know, Elon was Elon long before he was rich. Otherwise, he wouldn't be Elon. And you were who you were and who you are long before you what you're doing right now. So those things never change. On that topic, tell me about, you know, your childhood. You know, where did you grow up? And like, you know, why did you get interested in science and all that kind of stuff?
So I grew up in the middle of England. So it was never violent. It was never poor. It was never dangerous. But I would describe it as very mediocre in that there was very little ambition. So my parents were very clever and they were very, very ambitious for me and my brother. So we had a slightly unusual childhood in that there was a very, very strong emphasis on drawing, reading, art, music and sport, and a very low emphasis on things like watching television or playing computer games. So it was a very old-fashioned upbringing in a way, because it really focused on developing our minds, I guess, in interesting ways. A little bit like an experiment, perhaps, which maybe I didn't appreciate until I was in my early 20s. But essentially, it was relatively straightforward. A lot of sport and a lot of art. And at school, I absolutely didn't understand science at all, but I think it was taught very badly. I didn't really understand how I wanted to think about the world until I got to university and found a brilliant library for the first time and essentially lived there for about 3 years. And one of my favorite things to do was essentially go to the parts of the library that I wasn't supposed to go to because it wasn't my subject. So I was reading art history, but I would go and explore psychology, physics, and any science that drew me. So in a weird way, I think Volleyball is sort of in spite of my childhood in a large way, because there was certainly no sort of compelling science teacher where I thought, oh, I'm going to grow up to be a scientist. I was almost inoculated against science, and it was made so boring that I actually believed that it wasn't interesting. And it's only, I honestly, thanks to stuff like Google, if Google didn't exist, this brand would be very hard to run. This idea that you can now dive into any rabbit warren and educate yourself is just astonishing. And I still remember that we had a set of encyclopedias at home, and I probably read most of those from cover to cover many times. But this idea now that you can go and find any piece of information you want, anything you're interested in, and go and sort of like find expertise just through hard work.
I have a very simple explanation on childhood and what we do as grown-ups.
I'd love to hear it.
I think what we don't have as children actually shapes us much more than what we have as children. I think that's what we are always searching for. It's what we don't have. You know, I was talking to this very famous British photographer called Michael Kenna. And he also is from, I guess he's from the north of England. And I don't know where, which part of England. I didn't ask him the exact name of the city he's from. And we ended up talking about childhood and things we didn't have as children. And one of the things we ended up talking about, why both of us love shoes so much. And it kind of was like, those were the things which were in short supply when we were younger.
Oh, wow. Well, okay. So I remember when I was young, I remember Nike Air came out for the first time. And I remember being absolutely astonished that they'd put air in a shoe. And there was no way on earth I was allowed to buy a pair of Nike Air. I couldn't afford them. I wasn't allowed to wear them. And then the next year, Adidas brought out Adidas Torsion, which was not so successful, but when you're 13, was a really, really amazing thing. And I remember so desperately wanting to have those shoes. And in the end, I was allowed to buy a pair of Nike Pegasus because I was a runner. And so I was allowed a pair of running shoes each year because running's what we did. I slept with those shoes for a month before I even wore them, like inhaling the smell. So I think probably something about that love of objects probably does come through in the brand today. I could still tell you about the smell of that rubber.
You were not studying science at that time. So maybe that's why you are drawn to science now, right? Like science and materials and, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff, which probably was not part of your upbringing.
It might well be a hidden anger or resentment at how could they not teach me stuff that was so fascinating? I grew up to inherently believe that art was more interesting and superior to science.
It is.
Well, I still love it.
Because art gives context to science and technology. And I think, if anything, Silicon Valley doesn't understand that. It does not understand that art, psychology, our humanity is what makes science and tech more textural and more contextual. And like, it gives a little bit of like dimensionality to what it's supposed to do. And I think if you look at all the scientists in the past, all the great ones, they all talk about the relative unknown, the divine, the art. That's the important stuff. And I think because, you know, I guess in my case, I didn't really grow up, like no one in my family talked about science. And, you know, I got forced to read biology, chemistry, and science because, you know, like all good Indian kids, I had to do that in order to succeed in life. But my whole thing was like, I wanted the art part of it. Like for me, that was the magic because that was the window into the universe, because without the art, without the words, you can't really tell what science and tech do. And so, and you know, you can't add context without words and art. And I think, I mean, I'm on both sides of the fence here. Like, so I love science and tech, and, you know, without that, I would be lost. But I also appreciate the art aspect of it.
Well, I think one of the greatest mistakes over the last 100 years is the splitting apart of art and science as two separate dimensions. And obviously, if you go back to Leonardo, the greatest artist of all time was also the greatest scientist of all time. And then gradually we've seen the divorce of those two subjects, which I would absolutely agree is a mistake. One of my favorite sort of, it's not even a company, I suppose it's called the studio at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at NASA. And their job is simply to make space more exciting and more relevant. And that, isn't that wonderful? So you've got like a whole bunch of scientists putting, you know, the rovers on Mars, but then you have artists telling the world about it. I find that really exciting. I think those two worlds are going to merge again.
I know Steve Jobs seemed to do that pretty well. I think he understood and appreciated arts and science at the same time. And I think that kind of is why he had a successful brand more than anything, as a successful company. Let's go back to you. Let's not talk about Steve Jobs. What is the grand vision for you as a company? What do you dream of? Like, what is the next 10 years look like for you?
I do it on a much larger timescale than that. So I think we are very, very privileged to be alive at the time today. So I think in order to think about what we're attempting to achieve, I tend to go back 50,000 years to the invention of clothing, which was when Homo sapiens made it out of Africa, made it over to Europe, and it was rather cold. And there was rather a lot of ice there. That was the advent of clothing. And I think what's interesting about clothing is that ever since then, for the last 50,000 years, it's been there to serve a very similar purpose, which is to keep you warm or dry or cool in some cases, or confer status. And I think now for the first time, we're seeing a convergence of a whole series of different themes. I think with biotechnology, the emergence of space travel, the inventions of new materials and new life forms. And I think all of these things are going to come together to radically alter our perception of what clothing should be and can be. The one thing I don't know is the timescale that's going to be on. I'm absolutely convinced it's going to happen. We'll be, you know, wearing plasma skins, or I think our clothing has the vast potential to become our doctor, our breathing system, especially as we go to space. We've already seen those things happen before. What I'm profoundly interested in is being the company that takes those first steps. You can never guarantee that you're going to be the company that ends up owning that space. In the same way, SpaceX will probably take us to Mars, but it might be another company one day who commercializes that. What I'm interested in is being at the absolute forefront of driving that change so that clothing becomes something different to what we think of as it today. If we're here just doing a fashion brand, I simply wouldn't be interested. That's not what I'm into. I want to make clothes that people look good in and they feel good in and perform. But at the same idea, what I'm profoundly interested in is creating clothing that can essentially alter the plasticity of human life. If you look at exoskeletons starting to enhance strength, if you look at the early phases of Google Glass trying to essentially enhance sensory perception or intelligence, I think that's where it's going to go. That's what I'm interested in driving towards. If we make some really cool shirts, jackets and pants on the way, that's absolutely brilliant. And you have to be able to do that in order to have a company that works and clothing that people can wear. But at the same time, we're fundamentally driving at altering how people think about clothing in the same way I would argue Tesla have altered how a car should be.
So let's talk about that, right? Like now you have, again, you know, 1960s, we had Patagonia and North Face doing what they were doing, but were a very small subset of an audience. And now it's pretty mainstream product. Yes. Like, you know, even people like fashion brands, like LVMH is making puffers, right?
Yeah.
So it's only 50 plus years and like it's become a commonplace. You think that's what happens to some of your ideas in 50 years, they'll become commonplace?
I would think so. If you look at how innovation typically works, there's sort of three phases of it, which is the invention, the popularization, the commercialization. And there can be huge timescales on those. So whether you're looking at the silicon chip or electric cars, those things can operate on a timescale of 150 years between the moment something's invented and the moment it's truly commercialized and capitalized on. I think obviously what I'm interested in, because I'm not going to be alive for 150 years unless something crazy is invented, is reducing the timescale of those things. But essentially, I think if you make enough bets on the future, some of them are going to come right. That would be my hope.
Yeah. Do you think that your ideas and your approach will be able to overcome 125 years of sustained consumerism that has altered human behavior pretty strongly? Like we have been taught to buy more, buy better, you know, buy more expensive. You know, you were in advertising. Whole idea was to buy more.
Absolutely.
Your ideas of like baking these sustainable products and at the same time, the ground reality of consumerism and capitalism, Do you think about the volatile mix that is?
I do. We're always interested in working on things that we believe that we can actually influence. The first thing I think we can actually influence is perception. And so the way we've attempted to influence perception at the start is by trying to encourage people to think about how clothes are worn. So in making a plant and algae t-shirt, we're encouraging you to think by naming the things it is actually made out of. We're encouraging you to think of what is the rest of your clothing made out of. And then in making a little video of showing it being eaten by worms, we're encouraging you to bury it in the ground at the end of its life. So those are two kind of very, very small moments of perception that we can create. And then the other is we have a range of gear called 100-year clothing. And so it's a pair of pants, we've got a vest, we have a jacket, and we have a hoodie. And in calling it 100-year clothing, we're trying to make you think differently about your clothing. The idea is you should be buried in this. So the first thing we can alter is perception. I think then what happens, and obviously we're altering perception to what is at the moment a very small market of people who know that we exist. I think then you have to go back and look at what is enabling consumerism. And that's essentially the economic split of different countries. If providing there are countries where cheaper labor exists, you will always have cheaper products. And so I think that's a far, far bigger issue to tackle than perception. So perception is the first one you can start to make people think. But then essentially it's the economic divide that's going to create the opportunity for people to consume endlessly.
Do you have any thoughts on companies like Everlane having all this disclosure about where their products are made and their supply chain? I laugh at stuff like that. And it's like, but you're making $50 product and making me buy 10 t-shirts is pretty much, you're not really changing the conversation. You're just putting lipstick on a pig. I don't know how you think about that.
So I think two things about it. I think the notion of increased transparency in clothing is a good thing. If all clothing brands tomorrow had to provide you a video of how every single piece of clothing that you own is made, the clothing market would look completely different. If you were able to see the sweatshop stuff is made in, or the supply chains it's gone through, or the amounts of chemicals it's been through, the clothing market would look inherently different. So I am broadly supportive of anything that encourages transparency. I think on the flip side, you can play games with how you convey that transparency, because at the moment, no government or body is forcing any companies to do it. So essentially, they, as any other brand would be, is entering a game of how do they want to position themselves within that semi-transparent economy.
No matter how transparent you get, if your aim is to sell more and make people buy more, you're inherently lying to the world. Because at that point, you're not really solving the problem. You are part of the problem. Yeah, you have a cute video telling people this is how we make things and we don't have sweatshops. But it's still essentially you're feeding into the same larger issue, which is buy more. And I think that's a bigger challenge. And I don't think any of these companies ever talk about, you know, buy better and buy less. Because if that's what they did, then they wouldn't be valued highly in the market, right? So that probably is the crux of the problem right now. Anyway, let's shift gears. Let's talk about positive stuff. What materials are exciting you right now? You know, you said graphene. What else are you in love with right now?
I'm in love with using materials that we haven't typically thought about to make clothing out of before. I'm very interested in, as well as going really high tech, which we are profoundly interested in, I'm also interested in just going sideways. And so working with things like glass and wood and metal that people haven't thought about before. One of the things we're trying to discover is the two guys, Guy Novoselov, who won the Nobel Prize for isolating graphene, ran a thing, which they still do to this day, even now they both sit there with Nobel Prizes, called the Friday Night Experiments, where even though they work in one particular branch of science, every Friday they go and experiment in a bit of science that they're not very good at. And they talk about it being the beginner's mind. As scientists, they know enough to ask interesting questions, but they don't know so much about the thing that they're going to experiment in that they don't know to ask the wrong questions. And out of that, they were actually awarded the Ig Nobel Prize for levitating frogs by showing that the Earth's magnetic field could have an impact on a frog or something like that. So it's really crazy stuff. Essentially, we try and do really similar things like this. So we go and look at materials that clothing's never been made out of before and try and make clothing out of it just to see what happens. Because there might be a reason it's been rejected, or maybe no one's thought of it before. So we're enjoying going sideways at stuff. We're also getting more into, we're pushing deeper into graphene. So probably in the next 3 months, we'll be announcing a partnership where we're going to be pushing graphene into a territory that no one's pushed it before. It gets a little bit Harry Potter and SEAL Team 6 combined, where you end up thinking, what on earth is this and who might use it? So I'm terrifically excited about the potential for graphene still. I think that's really, really underexplored.
You know, one of the areas which I have been intrigued by is the recycling of old fabric, denim, and like, you know, combining it with old polyester, plastic. I'm still not educated enough to talk about it intelligently, but I kind of like the idea of reusing what we already have as a way of creating new things instead of creating new materials and like new fabrics and new output. And instead, I don't know, have you guys thought about...
We're working on 3 or 4 projects that explore that at the moment. We're particularly interested in, I don't know which part of India it is, but I believe that there's a mountain of rubbish that's about to collapse soon, and it's as high as some mountains. I'm very, very interested in going back to things that people believe they've thrown away. There's a wonderful exhibition in the Design Museum in London at the moment about our first trip to Mars as humanity. It's called Moving to Mars. And in it, there's a wonderful quote by, I can't remember which astronaut, but he goes, when you're up in space, the idea of throwing anything away is absurd, because you look down at Earth and you go, there is no away. Whatever you throw away, it's still on Earth. So yes, my brother and I are very, very interested in working on several projects where we go and look at what has technically been thrown away and what can be done with it. Because it isn't away, it's just in another country, or it's in landfill, or it's been put somewhere else. So I think there's more and more that can be done with that. We've both got children, so we both watched Wall-E about 6 times, where essentially a robot is having to build his entire world out of scrap. We're not there yet, but all the metrics say that this is where we're heading. So I think educating ourselves to work with old things as well as new things is something, yeah, we're interested in and we're looking at it.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining me today. I really wish you the very best in your journey. And I don't know if I'm going to be around to see most of it come to fruition. But I definitely believe in many of the products you've created and put into the market. I can only fit into 1 or 2. So I ordered one of them, which is I'm hoping to wear the indestructible puffer on my trip to Svalbard in the near future.
I think it will serve you well.
Yeah. And I'm just hoping that I don't have to wear anything more than a base merino layer. That's it.
I think you'll be okay.
Yeah. Thank you so much and good luck with everything. I really am really intrigued by your mission and your company and your ideas. And this is the kind of thinking we need. And, you know, not dystopian, but for a better tomorrow.
Thank you for having me.